Turning to world news now, and Italy's president has started meetings with political and parliamentary leaders to see who can form a new government and help save the nation from financial disaster. Economist Mario Monti is considered the top contender. President Giorgio Napolitano has been holding a series of back-to-back meetings all day. Silvio Berlusconi resigned as Prime Minister last night, as promised, as soon as urgent anti-crisis measures won final approval in Parliament. W. Bradford Wilcox is director of the National Marriage Project and professor of sociology at the University of Virginia. He was in Rome this week to attend a conference on the family and the economy hosted by the Acton Institute. He spoke to us about the impact of the economic crisis on families living in Italy and elsewhere in Europe.
The reason we're here speaking to you today is because you are in Rome to attend a conference that focuses on reconciling family life and working life. You yourself are the director of a research institute called the National Marriage Project, the Sustainable Demographic Dividend, within the University of Virginia. You're also, of course, a professor of sociology. Can't leave that important detail out. Can you just perhaps take us through the conference as it unfolded, the discussions and the interventions made at the conference, and your own feelings on the conference having taken place this week?
The big idea here, of course, is that there's a strong link between the family and the economy, between what happens in the family, also in how successful businesses are in doing their own work. And there were basically two different themes that emerged in the conference. The first is that what happens in the family basically spills out and affects the economy as a whole, and then also affects the welfare of particular sectors of the economy. The second theme that emerged in the conference was that to the extent that companies can do a better job of fostering a family-friendly environment within their corporation, they're going to have employees who are more committed to the work of the company, who are more motivated to do their work well, and that, you know, that sense of not worrying about what's happening, you know, at the home vis-a-vis the workplace, makes them, at least over the long term, better employees and more loyal employees. So, the basic idea is that sometimes there's a recognized tension between family and work that certainly exists for many of us at times. But the point is that if we can harmonize work and family to a large degree, that redounds both to the benefit of the family as well as to the workplace and to businesses.
The timing of the conference couldn't have been better, really, could it? If we think about this week in Italian history, Italy, of course, is the focus of international attention, particularly regarding the possible default or bankruptcy of the state, which is the third largest economy in Europe, seventh, apparently, in the world. Is there the risk, however, that in the current economic climate, too much focus is taken off the family and put on trying to resolve the crisis, higher tax, dipping into patrimonies, economic patrimonies, which could, in the end, make matters even worse rather than better?
Well, that's a great question. I think the way we approached it was sort of to say that what's happening right now in Europe is related in large part to what's happened demographically in Europe over the last 40 years. And by that, I mean we've seen the baby boom is now aging, and they're requiring more public support from the state in Italy, the state in Germany, the state in Greece. And yet, because of sustained low fertility in countries like Greece and Italy and Spain, to some extent, there are fewer workers in the workplace to pay taxes, to pay for public policies and public benefits for those who are retiring or who are already retired in those countries. So we were looking at it more from the opposite perspective in my session, that is, how do demographic changes in Europe over the last 40 years, how do they basically, or how have they made an important negative contribution to the fiscal welfare of states like, for instance, Italy and soon, we think, Germany. Now, to what you have just said, I think the challenge becomes, can governments like Italy, also this is true in the states, governments in the United States, can they take steps to reduce the fiscal burden of pensions and whatnot for their older populations? By, for instance, raising the retirement age and also by reducing benefits, at least in the United States case, for older Americans who are wealthy and don't really need the benefits of Social Security in our case. So, but there certainly is going to be pain, and pain for the family and pain for many people. But I think the alternative is to just continue to accrue massive debt, and that that spells disaster, as we're already seeing today in Italy.
Absolutely. There's no doubt that one of the only ways out of this crisis is to try and boost growth. How can you boost growth if you're not boosting families? Because they are the number one consumer. Do you see a certain reticence in governments to recognize the fact that by very subtly and very gradually legislating against the family, and also businesses very gradually and very subtly over the years, increasingly putting pressure on employees to put off having families, that this in a way is one of the major effects of this? I mean, we cannot have growth if we don't have families. And how do we resolve it? I mean, it's easy to say, yes, let's all go out and have children. But when you have young people in their 30s who have no stable employment.
Right. Well, yeah, on the first front, it is the case that over the long term, babies turn into consumers, workers, and taxpayers. And so if you don't have enough babies, you're not going to have enough workers, consumers, and taxpayers, which, you know, is going to be obviously an impediment to growth, and is going to be a challenge to the health of the state as well. I think the challenge, though, in much of Southern Europe, as you just hinted at, is that in many countries now, is that we have large sectors of young adults who are not employed, and therefore they are postponing parenthood in part because they're not employed. So I think the challenge then for countries like Italy, like Greece, like Spain, is to revisit their laws regarding employment policies and to reduce the regulatory burden facing companies, so the companies are freer to hire and fire, which we have seen in much of the world, including the United States, is linked to a decline in youth unemployment, because companies are more likely to hire someone if they're not worried about having to keep that person for you know basically forever until that person dies. Whereas if they have the freedom to, as I said before, to hire and fire, they're more likely to hire employees, and that actually in the long term reduces the level of youth unemployment.
Yet in old Europe, that probably is the nightmare of most of its population, the idea that you don't have a job for life. They really just cannot get their minds around it.
Right.
How can they learn from economies like the American economy, like Northern European economies? I'm thinking of Scandinavia, Great Britain.
Sure.
Even the emerging economies in Asia.
Right. Well, I think what the policymakers can do is provide a certain level of security that's linked not to the job, but to things like healthcare and education, where basically people are confident they can have some resources to navigate the complexities of this world, the tremendous changes we're seeing in this world, in the economic arena and many other arenas, so that there is some basic stability that the government can help to foster. But to recognize that if you want the economy operating on all cylinders, so to speak, you need to give companies the flexibility to do a number of things in terms of hiring and firing. And if you don't do that, you're going to pay a long-term price. And you're also going to pay a short-term price in terms of having large numbers of young people who can't find jobs because the companies are reluctant to hire them until they're absolutely sure they want that person.
Another issue, of course, these are all great ideas in theory. How are they received? How is your dialogue with those companies, with civil partners? I'm thinking here of legislators, government bodies. Are they getting the message, do you think?
I think we're really more in the beginning stages of education on this issue. So this report was featured in the New York Times and in the United States, National Public Radio, McLean's in Canada, and many other North American publications, as well as many in Spain now, too. And I think people are just beginning to wrap their heads around this idea that the family, I think over the last 30 or 40 years, the idea has been the family is a private sphere. It does no broader implication for the state or for the society. And people can do whatever they want in the family without, the intervention of others. And we're trying to basically tell them, no, that's not true. What happens in the family doesn't stay in the family. Actually, as I said before, it goes out into the larger society and to the economy in particular. So given that reality, public policies should do more to strengthen and support the family. But the most important point I think we make in this report in terms of what can be done is that businesses need to recognize that they have a long-term interest, particularly businesses that sell products that are geared towards families, businesses like insurance companies, for instance. People who are married with kids buy more insurance. Healthcare is the same thing. Grocery stores, agriculture, childcare, juvenile products, household products, all these different sectors of the economy are more likely to flourish, to prosper, to profit when people follow love with marriage and the baby carriage. And so given that reality, to take the United States, for instance, the largest purchaser of advertising in the United States is a company called Procter & Gamble, P&G. And I don't think P&G has been really intentional about using its advertising power to both influence the character of the shows that it advertises on and also to make sure that its own ads are family-friendly. But, you know, if they want to make a profit, they should be a lot more intentional because they will make a lot more money when people in America, for instance, or actually now around the world because P&G sells products around the world, when people both in the U.S. and around the world get married and have kids. So specifically, we encourage companies, particularly family-dependent companies like Procter & Gamble, to support philanthropic efforts to strengthen the family, to use their advertising power strategically and prudently on behalf of the family, and then also to be involved in social marketing campaigns that are beginning to sprout up in many parts of the world, including the United States, that are designed to encourage people to get married and to invest in their families, and particularly to have men who often are more likely to be distanced from the family to be successfully incorporated into the family as fathers. So the view is that if we can get companies to be more intentional about supporting the family, they will then, over the long term, benefit from more consumers, better workers, you know, and that's good for them and it's good for the society.
You're approaching this from a very, you know, scientific background. Obviously, that's your field as a sociologist. Speak to me a little bit about the reality in the United States, which I think can be reflected also in other Western European, Western countries of the West, Western world. To what extent has the lobbying for the recognition of the rights of the individual, the recognitions of other forms of civil union, other form of family life, how much has that or does it have an effect on the economy?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think what I would say is that really since the late 1960s, there's been a number of changes in family law and public policy that have gradually eroded the distinctive power and status of marriage in the United States. And it's certainly not the only factor that's affected the family, but it's certainly an important factor. One of my colleagues at UVA found that the shift towards no-fault divorce in the 1970s in the United States accounted for about a 17% of the increase that we saw in divorce in the United States over that period, which is a big increase. I mean, there was a huge increase in divorce in the 70s in the United States. So these changing public policies and the interest groups that are, you know, advocating for less recognition for marriage, less recognition for the family, they do have an effect. And, you know, as our report suggests, we think that both at the macro level and for particular sectors of the economy, that effect is often negative. Now, of course, to be fair, there are some, if you look at, for instance, people who are single drink more beer than people who are married with kids. And so probably the demographics we've been seeing throughout the West are helping, you know, Anheuser-Busch and Corona to sell their products.
There was that theory, however, that was floated around, particularly in the naughty 90s, as they said, that, you know, individuals, the single, was actually a better market commodity than the family. And that has increased the idea of advertising, business marketing, you know, geared completely towards the single and individual to the detriment of the family.
And of course, there are sectors that I think the entertainment sector, the alcohol sector, that, you know, that, for instance, clearly do better when people don't get married and have kids. There's no doubt about that. But what I would say is that the problem with encouraging a more single lifestyle for the population as a whole, of course, is that that is not sustainable, literally. I mean, you look at Japan now, it's had probably the longest tradition in recent years of sustained low fertility. Japan is literally shrinking. Year to year, it's getting smaller. And the economy is stagnating in Japan. And the debt of the Japanese state is surging, they predict, to 600% of the GDP by 2030 as they pay for all these old people who have no younger people to support them, you know, as workers and taxpayers. So on the one hand, I think the family is in a predicament in much of the world. The good news here is that this predicament literally cannot be sustained. It's gonna end one way or another. And this sort of fantasy you can kind of, you know, foster a single carefree lifestyle forever, you know, is just that, a fantasy.
My final question is, what hope or what are your hopes for your report, The Sustainable Demographic Dividend? What effects are you hoping this report can have?
I think really the hope here is that we're going to be able to begin a conversation with, particularly with companies around the world, to, and especially companies that depend for their bottom line on selling products to people who, you know, are in families, to get them to realize that if they want to protect their, you know, their market, they should be more intentional about using their economic and cultural power to strengthen the family rather than being indifferent or even hostile to it. And so we are planning, for instance, a report next year looking at the link between family structure at the state level and economic growth at the state level. And, you know, with these kinds of research efforts, the hope is to begin to educate executives, business owners, and people who are concerned with the health of the economy, which, of course, is a much, much more salient issue these days, to see how what happens in the family impacts the economic arena.
You're listening to Vatican Radio.